From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with America's Poet Laureate, Ted Kooser. As he points out in his new book, The Poetry Home Repair Manual, you'll never be able to make a living writing poems. He didn't. For 25 years, he woke up early to write before going to work at a life insurance company in Nebraska. Mortality is a subject he's always written about, but he became even more focused on it after he was diagnosed with cancer. When he was recovering, he wrote over 100 short poems on postcards to his friend, the writer Jim Harrison. We'll hear some of those poems as well as others. Our Poet Laureate, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From the major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel Night and Day in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Delacorte Press, publisher of Everything Changes, a novel about love and the perils of a well-planned life by Jonathan Tropper, author of The Book of Joe, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ted Kooser, is the U.S. Poet Laureate, the 13th writer to have that distinction. He doesn't like poems that require elaborate explanations, and he doesn't write them. His new book, The Poetry Home Repair Manual, offers practical advice for beginning poets. His book, Winter Morning Walks, published in 2000, was a series of short poems that he sent on postcards to his friend, the writer Jim Harrison, during the period Kooser was recovering from oral cancer. Many of those poems were about mortality. That's a subject he's always written about. His latest poems are collected in his book, Delights and Shadows. Kooser is the first poet laureate to be chosen from the Great Plains. He grew up in Iowa and lives in Nebraska. The writer Charles Baxter said of Kooser, "He has great gifts for both portraiture and landscape, and another gift for dramatizing what is nearly invisible. He is a seer." As Kooser points out in the Poetry Home Repair Manual, you'll never be able to make a living writing poems. He hasn't. Until his recent retirement, he worked at a life insurance company. Let's start with his poem, A Death at the Office.
This poem is probably almost 40 years old. I had my first job in the insurance business, working for a company called Bankers Life Nebraska. And this was a woman in our department who had died, and the poem is set on the morning following her death. A Death at the Office. The news goes desk to desk like a memo, initial and pass on. Each of us marks surprised or sorry. The management came early and buried her nameplate deep in her desk. They have boxed up the My Doll and Lip Ice, the snapshots from home, wherever it was. Nephews and nieces, a strange blurred cat with fiery flashbulb eyes as if it grieved. But who grieves here? We have her ball points back, her bud vase. One of us tears the scribbles from her calendar.
The details in that poem are so recognizable. The lip ice in the drawer, the snapshots from home. I love your description of the blurred cat with the fiery flashbulb eyes. You know, you write in your book, The Poetry Home Repair Manual, about how important it is to have details in a poem.
Oh, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the details in that poem, about deciding what to put in?
Well, the more specific the detail, the more true the experience seems. You know, if I had said, rather than lip ice, if I had said lip salve, it would have been a different thing altogether. Using the brand name even makes it more specific and therefore more real somehow. I'm not sure exactly how this works psychologically, but this is something I've learned over the years.
When you say at the end, "But who grieves here in the office," what were you thinking with that?
Well, I was, of course, speaking ironically at that point. I mean, there were people who felt sorry about it, but it seemed as if the management was, moving too quickly to just sort of obliterate her from the history, you know. So I'm speaking sort of tongue-in-cheek at the end about we have her ball points back, her bud vase. In other words, after all, we got our things back, you know, that sort of thing. So,
The office that you refer to in that poem, the office at which you worked for many years, was a life insurance company. And you worked there until retiring in 1999. How did you end up a poet working in an insurance company for most of your career?
Well, I was a poet first, and I came to Lincoln, Nebraska to go to graduate school because Carl Shapiro, who was a famous, celebrated poet, was here, and I wanted to study with him. And I was given an assistantship as a graduate student and just did a terrible job as a graduate student. I didn't do anything I was supposed to. All I cared about was poetry and hanging around with Carl Shapiro. So at the end of the year, they kind of threw me out of the graduate program, said they were cutting off my assistantship money and so on. So I had to find something to do. My first wife had a job teaching school, but I needed some sort of source of income, and I was fumbling through the paper, and I came upon this management trainee job at an insurance company. I thought, well, maybe I could do that, make some money, and I can go back to school on my own tuition and so on. And so for some reason or other, they hired me to this. I had no business training. I'd never had a business course. I didn't even know what insurance was, really, but they hired me, and I went to work there, and I began writing my poems early in the morning. I'd get up at 4:30 or 5 and write until I had to get ready to go to work, and that set me up in a sort of a habit that I have persisted in all these years. And I worked for that first company for 8 years, and then I moved on to another company and did the rest of my time at the second company. But it was always, the job was always really to support me as a writer, but I never really returned to academic life. I don't think I would have been good at it, although I am teaching a little bit now in my dotage.
So what was your position at the life insurance company that you worked at?
Well, I started out answering letters from policyholders who were writing in about their beneficiaries and so on, and then I moved into underwriting, and I was the underwriter is the person who reads your application and decides whether or not your medical history will allow you to have the policy and so on. I did that for 25 years probably, and then I moved into the marketing department in public relations as a writer, and I headed up a department of public relations, did the company newsletters and so on, and that's what I was doing. I retired as a vice president of public relations for Lincoln Benefit Life Company.
One of the things I find really fascinating here is that as a poet, many of your poems are about mortality. Now, you work for a life insurance company, which is also about mortality, but, you know, the language that you'd use in a life insurance company to discuss life and death is really different than the language you're going to use as a poet in talking about it.
Well, yes, I think that's right. You know, it's not the language of poetry is not the same sort of actuarial language, for sure. I do think that, you know, having been an underwriter all those years and reading medical reports day after day about people being ill and having fatal illnesses sometimes and everything, it really was a kind of morbid experience for me that I think must have soaked into my bones a little bit. But, you know, poetry is really about, in many ways, is about keeping death sort of in the corner of the room and acknowledging it's there and celebrating life because death is there waiting for us and so on. I think a great deal of lyric poetry is that way. And so, you know, I came to that kind of naturally, I think.
Well, there's a poem I want you to read that I think perfectly fits the description that you just gave of poetry. This is a poem called The Mourners.
Okay.
Could you tell us when you wrote it?
I wrote this maybe 10, 15 years ago after a funeral here locally. It was a sunny day, and we, you know, everybody filed out of the funeral out onto the yard of the church. And it just struck me, I was standing apart from them. I like to be always on sort of on the outside looking in, and I was standing apart from this group of mourners thinking about the way they were interacting. Here's the poem. Mourners. After the funeral, the mourners gather under the rustling churchyard maples and talk softly, like clusters of leaves. White shirt cuffs and collars flash in the shade, highlights on deep green water. They came this afternoon to say goodbye, but now they keep saying hello and hello, peering into each other's faces, slow to let go of each other's hands.
And that poem is included in Ted Kooser's latest collection of poems, Delights and Shadows. And Ted Kooser is the Poet Laureate of the U.S. There's no I in that poem. You're talking about them, about the mourners. But you're obviously there as a mourner yourself. Why did you not include yourself in the poem?
Oh, gosh, Terry, I'm not sure about that. I very rarely use the first-person pronoun in a poem. I much prefer to be observing something at some detachment. I don't know, I don't think it would have felt right with me in that group of mourners. I needed to be standing apart looking at them.
You know, we were talking about mortality and poetry. A few years ago, you really had to deal with your own mortality. You had cancer, oral cancer, that affected your tongue, your salivary glands were removed. You don't like to write about your feelings very much. You like to hold things at a distance, but when something like cancer hits you, how much of a distance can you put that? I mean, that's a hard one to.
Yeah, when I was going through radiation therapy and so on, I didn't write at all. And then, as I was coming out of it, since I'd had head and neck radiation, I was photosensitive and I couldn't be out in the sunlight without getting a terrible burn. And so I would go for really early morning walks before the sun came up, and then I would, trying to fasten on to life. You know, when you've really looked death in the teeth, you tend to be very attentive to everything in life and want to celebrate even the least thing. And I would find these, something on my walk, a rock or something like that, and take it home and try to write a little poem. And then my friend Jim Harrison, who's a poet and novelist, was down in Arizona that winter, and I would paste them on a postcard and send them down to him. And it was really very good for me to be doing that. Poetry for me is a lot about trying to find some little piece of order in a very disorderly and sometimes chaotic world. And I was really facing disorder and chaos with cancer. But the fact that I could make a little poem every day was very reassuring to me. And it was quite a marvelous experience. And this book was written, I wrote 130 of them day after day, which is, I've never written like that under any other circumstances, you know. It was a very unique experience, and the book, I think, shows that it's a sort of a different critter from the rest of my work.
I think it's interesting that you wrote these poems each day on a postcard. Postcards are so informal and tossed off. You know, you don't labor over a postcard. Did the fact that you were putting them on a postcard help you fuss less and just write?
You know, to tell you the truth, Terry, I think I put them on postcards because they only cost 23 cents.
That's a good practical answer.
Yeah, rather than the 37. But I've always liked the postcard as almost a literary form. Early in my writing career, I wrote poems based on the messages that had been written on old postcards that I'd find at antique shops and so on. And you know, they're so marvelously compressed because you have just this tiny little space in which to write. And so all the poems in that book, of course, are quite small, too. But, you know, the messages are sometimes quite marvelous, like a typical one would be just a line or two to let you know that everything's all right before the postman comes and I see him coming up the walk right now, goodbye, you know, that sort of thing.
Sickness can make you very self-absorbed because you're monitoring the changes in your symptoms. You're often depressed, and there's not a lot of energy for engaging with the world sometimes. So what are some of the things that you found most healing? I mean, I know, like, for instance, you say you took a walk every day before the sun came up. Was that a way and part of getting out of yourself, of trying to get out of preoccupation with symptoms?
Well, I think that in part, surely. But, you know, I had been very ill, and radiation is, head and neck radiation is very tough, and I really needed to get my strength back. So the walk was as much for exercise and trying to get my strength back as anything else. And it just happened that I was able, as I have been most of my life, was able to make something out of something else, you know, to get a little bonus out of those walks by writing a little something about them.
I'd like you to read a poem from Winter Morning Walks from February 19th. Maybe you could just set it up for us.
All right. This is one of those poems I wrote following a walk. At this time, I'm back in the house, sitting in my chair with my little notebook. February 19, 35 degrees and drizzling. In this poem, I talk about flickers, which is a flicker is a oversized woodpecker that we have a lot of them out on the Great Plains. And this particular one is called the yellow-shafted flicker. They are marvelous big birds, and so here we go. When I switched on a light in the barn loft late last night, I frightened four flickers hanging inside, peering out through their holes. Confused by the light, they began to fly wildly from one end to the other, their yellow wings slapping the tin sheets of the roof, striking the walls, scrabbling and falling. I cut the light and stumbled down and out the door and stood in the silent dominion of starlight till all five of our hearts settled down.
What a lovely image at the end. Was there a point when you thought of it that way, of all five of your hearts quieting down?
Well, you know what that is, I think. It's being in the natural community. You know, we're I'm afraid, they're afraid, and it was a frightening experience, frankly, to be up in that attic with these birds flying from one end to the other. You know, they're good-sized birds, and my heart was beating wildly, and theirs were too, and I just thought, well, we're all in this together.
My guest is the poet laureate Ted Kooser. His latest book is called The Poetry Home Repair Manual, Practical Advice for Beginning Poets. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. When you hear poetry on the radio, you hardly have to look at the dial to see what station is on. You can be pretty sure it's public radio. Let's face it, radio and TV doesn't exactly specialize in quiet reflection about mortality. We can afford to be different only because instead of commercial sponsors, our listeners contribute a large portion of the station's budget. Your station is fundraising today because it has to in order to pay the bills. Please call and make sure we continue to have a place on the radio for reflection. Thank you. My guest is Ted Kooser. He's the poet laureate of the United States. His latest book is called The Poetry Home Repair Manual, and it's about writing poetry. His latest collection of poems is called Delights and Shadows. I want you to read a poem from Winter Morning Walks, and this one is set November 14th, and I should mention that each poem starts with, like, a description of the weather that day.
Mm-hmm. November 14, in the low 40s and clear. My wife and I walk the cold road in silence, asking for 30 more years. There's a pink and blue sunrise with an accent of red. A hunter's cap burns like a coal in the yellow-gray eye of the woods.
The poem is almost in two parts. One part, you're thinking about your mortality, and then the other part is almost like, more like a haiku or something.
Yeah, it's the... most poems are upside, most poems would be the other way around. You'd have the image first and then the more general information afterwards. But this one, you know, I'm with her and yet I'm looking to the side and seeing something in the world other than us and other than our thoughts.
You know, the poet Seiko Sundiata once said something to the effect that the most important organ in your body is the one that hurts. I think, how true. And you had a little tumor on your tongue that had to be removed. And the tongue is already at the center of your body. It's the part that you need for talking, for swallowing, for eating. And it's such a sensitive part of your body, too. And, you know, as a writer, what was it like for you during that period right after the surgery? And I imagine there was a period like this when you couldn't talk.
Well, we were afraid going into the surgery that I'd have to learn to talk again and so on. As it turned out, they didn't have to take as much tissue as they thought they would. But, my objective was to try to do everything the doctors told me and get through this, and I could set writing aside and doing poetry readings and stuff. One of the interesting things about this, I had a marvelous doctor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, a man named Bill Lydiot, and we had our first appointment with him, and he said, "I'm going to have to take a piece of your tongue out. Do you do any public speaking?" And I said, "Well, nothing that I couldn't give up if I had to." And my wife was there, and she said, "Well, you know, he is a poet. He does poetry readings." And so Bill made a note of that, and I didn't think any more of it. And then we had another appointment in about a week or 10 days. And by that time, he had gone to the Omaha Public Library and checked out my books and read them. You know, you don't find doctors like that It was really a marvelous thing. So it set us up in a position of, or in a relationship of trust that I rely on to this day.
But was there a period when you couldn't speak?
No, actually, I could speak. I didn't sound very good, but I began speaking almost the minute I came out of anesthesia.
And was there a period when you felt like the world was centered around your mouth and all the things that it couldn't do quite right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, there was a lot of discomfort with this, if not outright pain. And, yeah, you know, the whole experience was very much day-to-day, you know, and fighting this, you know, this terrible fear, you know, that something's going to happen next, you know, something more is going to happen and so on. I think cancer patients probably all must, you know, spend so much of their time looking over their shoulder, waiting for something to come sneaking up behind them again, you know.
And I'm going to ask you now to read a poem that's about anxiety. And this was also from your book of 100 poems that you wrote on postcards when you were sick. And this is a poem from December 25th. It's a Christmas Day poem.
Okay. December 25th, sunny and clear. Sometimes when things are going well, the daredevil squirrel of worry suddenly leaps from the back of my head to the feeder, swings by his paws and clambers up, twitching his question mark tail. And though I try the recommended baffles, tin cone of meditation, greased pipe of positive thought, every sunflower seed in this life is his if he wants it.
Ted Kooser will be back in the second half of the show. His latest books are the Poetry Home Repair Manual, Practical Advice for Beginning Poets, and a collection of poems called Delights and Shadows. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ted Kooser's poems and reflections about his father, memory, and the fading of memories, and a question many of us asked ourselves, how do those bold tattoos look when you get older, much older? I guess.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org, and from Warner Home Video, presenting the drama series The West Wing, the complete fourth season on DVD, including special features.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the poet laureate Ted Kooser. He's the first poet laureate from the Great Plains. He grew up in Iowa and has spent his adult life in Nebraska. Kuser's latest collection of poems is called Delights and Shadows. In his new book, The Poetry Home Repair Manual, he offers practical advice for beginning poets. You'd worked your whole adult life in the life insurance business and wrote your poems in the very, very early morning. You quit at about the age of 60 after getting diagnosed with cancer. And now you're poet laureate, something I'm sure you were not expecting.
Absolutely not.
How did you find out the news, and did you have any idea what it would mean, like what it would mean in terms of day-to-day life, what your duties would be?
Well, you know, this is something that had never occurred to me in my wildest dreams that would ever happen to me. And I was at home one night. It was a Friday evening, I remember. And my wife was in Washington, D.C. on business, and I got a phone call, and the man said, Ted Kuser. I said, yes. He said, Ted Kuser, the poet? I said, yes. He said, I'm wondering how you'd like to be the next poet laureate of the United States. And I was so completely flummoxed by this, and sort of stammering and, you know, trying to come up with something I could say and so on, that he finally said, well, I think I better call you back tomorrow. And it was like that. I've told a story about immediately realized I had a couple of CD movies, DVDs overdue at this little town nearby, and I jumped in the car and threw the movies on the seat, just completely taken up with all this poet laureate stuff, and I backed out of the garage and ripped the side mirror off the garage on the side of the garage and drove all the way to the body shop and got the price on it. It was going to be $140 to fix the mirror, and went home groaning about having done that. Pulled in the garage, and I still had the DVDs on the seat of the car, you know, that sort of thing. It was like that for weeks, really.
Right. Now, you're the first poet laureate from Nebraska, or from the Great Plains, for that matter. And just describe where you live in Nebraska.
Well, we are in eastern Nebraska. Lincoln, Nebraska is the state capital. We live about 20 miles north and west of Lincoln in an area of low rolling hills that were eroded out of the plain by a glacier of some kind of formation. It's very pretty country. We have 62 acres. It's wooded, rolling hills, as I said, prairie grass. I have a little pond, some old farm buildings that I've converted to various purposes. I have a library building, a building where I can paint. I like to paint, things like that.
As I mentioned, you're the first poet laureate from the Great Plains. Do you think of your poetry as being rooted to your sense of place?
Well, I absolutely it is. We tell young writers to write what they know. You know, of course, I've never lived anywhere but Iowa and Nebraska, so that's what I know and that's what I write about. It is interesting to me, though, Terry, at times people talk about seeing the Great Plains in my work, but if you look at the individual poems, you know, I have a poem about a tattooed man at a yard sale, and, you know, there's nothing specifically Nebraskan about that, or Great Plains for that matter. But there must be just enough little pieces throughout that sort of add up to something.
I happen to really like that poem, Tattoo, that you just mentioned. It's in your collection, Delights and Shadows. Would you read it for us?
Sure. Tattoo. What once was meant to be a statement, a dripping dagger held in the fist of a shuddering heart, is now just a bruise on a bony old shoulder, the spot where vanity once punched him hard and the ache lingered on. He looks like someone you had to reckon with, strong as a stallion, fast and ornery. But on this chilly morning, as he walks between the tables at a yard sale, with the sleeves of his tight black T-shirt rolled up to show us who he was, he is only another old man, picking up broken tools and putting them back, his heart gone soft and blue with stories.
Did you know the man you were writing about?
No, I didn't, no. I just, there again, you know, I was watching from afar, from some distance.
Do you have any tattoos?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I didn't think you did.
Do you?
No, actually.
Okay.
No, but I often wonder what it will be like for people who have a lot of tattoos when they do get older.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I set that poem up at readings, I often say, I'm sure that there are people in the audience who have tattoos. Tattoos have become very popular, but this is a poem about what they look like after 40 years. You know.
Right. Now, you grew up in Ames, Iowa. Your parents met when they both worked at the general store. Did that store exist when you were growing up?
Yes, it was. It was a dry goods store, and they met there. My father was the drapery manager, and my mother was a clerk who had come to Ames to live with her sister, the way young women used to do, and they met there. And recently I had a lovely letter from a woman who remembered them as young people. She had moved away from Ames before I was even born. My parents were very formal. I never saw them embrace. I never saw them kiss. You know, I think they were very fond of each other, but they were very, very formal. And this woman told me, she said, "Your father was so dashing and handsome, and your mother was so sweet and demure. We thought it was the romance of the century." You know.
What did your father end up doing professionally?
He was a store manager all of his life, retired in his 60s. He was the first manager of the first branch that a big department store in Des Moines, the Yonker Brothers, opened back in the days when nobody had even thought of a branch store or any kind of franchising at all. And he stayed with Yonkers all his life.
You write about your mother that she kept track of every penny the family spent, and she kept track of it in dime store spiral notebooks. Did you ever use those notebooks to write poems?
Not the little ones that she used, but I sure used spiral notebooks, of course, yeah. Yes, mother was amazing. She could live for a couple of weeks on a half a head of cabbage and two wieners, you know, and she was just like that, you know.
You say she walks beside me through every store I enter saying, "Do you really need that?"
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll never get, she'll never let me go, you know. I had her buy a couple of automobiles for me once. She was so good at that kind of thing. She would walk into the showroom with her little Mamie Eisenhower pillbox hat on and carrying her little purse that matched, and somehow or other knock the price off, you know, several thousand dollars, you know, by the time she was done with these salesmen who were sort of wringing their hands looking as if they'd been beaten, you know.
I think your mother died while you were getting your radiation treatments.
Actually, she died before I'd been diagnosed.
Oh.
She died in March, and I was diagnosed in June.
Oh, that's pretty close.
Yeah. I've often thought that, you know, perhaps the grief of dealing with her dying, you know, had maybe knocked my immune system or something rather like that. Who knows? You'll never know about those things.
Did she live near you, and were you very close?
She lived in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is about 300 miles from where I live. But you know, we were very close, and I talked to her, a couple times a week, and so on. I was very devoted to her, and she to me, I think.
Now, your father died, about 20 years ago?
Yeah. Uh-huh, he did, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have a really interesting poem about your father that's in your latest collection, Delights and Shadows, that I'd like you to read for us and to introduce for us, if you wouldn't mind.
All right. My father was born on May 19th, and this is a story. There's a story that's told in the poem about how his mother saw lilacs out the window at the moment of his birth. And I wrote this on his birthday. "Father, today you would be 97 if you had lived, and we would all be miserable. You and your children, driving from clinic to clinic, an ancient, fearful hypochondriac and his fretful son and daughter, asking directions, trying to read the complicated, fading map of cures. But with your dignity intact, you have been gone for 20 years. And I am glad for all of us, although I miss you every day. The heartbeat under your necktie, the hand cupped on the back of my neck, Old Spice in the air, your voice delighted with stories. On this day each year, you love to relate that at the moment of your birth, your mother glanced out the window and saw lilacs in bloom. Well, today, lilacs are blooming in side yards all over Iowa, still welcoming you." You know, Terry, on his 100th birthday, what would have been his 100th birthday, my wife and I drove to Ames and went to that house, there's a lilac bush in the yard that was blooming on that day, a 100-year-old lilac.
You know, I'm not really sure how to take that poem. Like at the beginning, when you talk about how you're glad he's dead and that he's not going through the indignities of being the 97-year-old hypochondriac looking for cures and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you mean that literally or whether you're trying to make him and you feel better about the fact that he had to die so long ago.
Probably all of that. You know, it is true that sometimes, you know, I think he probably was spared a great deal of emotional suffering because he really was a hypochondriac. And if somebody had told him he died of acute leukemia that had not even been diagnosed until he was really on his deathbed, but if someone at that time had told him that there was a cure in Paris, France, for that, he would have insisted on getting there, you know, somehow or other, and you know, even a quirky cure of some kind, a quack cure, he would have wanted to pursue. And I don't know, I think he was spared a tremendous amount of anxiety by just being taken, you know.
How did somebody who's a hypochondriac and probably very absorbed in symptoms manage to not get diagnosed for so long?
Well, you know, he seemed to be getting weaker and weaker over a number of months, and he'd been to the doctor, and I frankly don't know how it was not diagnosed, but he finally got so weak that he just collapsed, and he died within 24 hours.
What did your parents think about your life as a poet?
You know, mother was more supportive than dad was. You know, when I was a young man, they thought, well, you know, maybe he ought to be doing something a little more productive with his time, you know. But they were quite, I think they liked the idea. Of course, before they died, I was publishing poems in some pretty good magazines and so on. So they saw me as being somewhat successful, which helped, I think.
What got you interested in poetry? Did you read it when you were very young?
I did read it. You know, when we were in grade school, I had a couple of teachers who were, you know, showed us how to write poems, and I wrote some little poems. One of them my mother kept, of course. It was, I love my dog, his padded paws. At Christmas, he's my Santa Claus, that sort of thing, you know, and I did a lot of that. And then in high school, I wrote hundreds of long, tortured poems to my girlfriend, and fortunately, when we broke up, she burned them all. It's good, you know.
No blackmail so coming from her now.
No, they're out there. They're gone. They're all ashes now. And then, you know, I always wanted to be, I think, having grown up in a very ordinary middle-class family in an ordinary middle-class community, I always wanted to be different. You know, I thought, oh boy, this is, you know, how could I be different from the rest of these people? And, you know, so I painted and I wrote poems and I tried to dress differently, you know, and all those things, you know, that you do in adolescence to try to set yourself apart in some way. And poetry kind of came out of that in a way. And it was also about girls, you know. I mean, I kept seeing these pictures of rumpled old John Berryman with his grizzled beard, and he was surrounded by these gorgeous co-eds, and you know, I didn't have much going for me. I wasn't very good looking. I had no athletic ability. But I thought, well, you know, maybe poetry might be something I could do, you know, that sort of thing. I'm speaking somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I think that was a big motivating part of it early on. And then I got hooked and started reading poetry, and before long I was completely immersed in it, and I've never let up.
My guest is the poet laureate Ted Kooser. His latest book is called The Poetry Home Repair Manual, Practical Advice for Beginning Poets. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is the poet laureate Ted Kooser. His latest books are The Poetry Home Repair Manual, Practical Advice for Beginning Poets, and a collection of poems called Delights and Shadows. So much of poetry, as you've pointed out in your new book, is about finding the telling details and then describing them as accurately as possible. But of course, memories fade, and I think that's part of the problem with any kind of writing. You want to kind of grasp those specific details, and you might not remember them anymore. And you have a really good poem about memory called Tectonics. Would you read that for us?
Sure. Tectonics. In only a few months, there begin to be fissures in what we remember. And within a year or two, the facts break apart one from another and slowly begin to shift and turn, grinding, pushing up over each other until their shapes have been changed and the past has become a new world. And after many years, even a love affair, one lush green island all to itself, perfectly detailed with even a candle softly lighting a smile, may slide under the waves like Atlantis, scarcely rippling the heart.
Do you think of the loss of memory as being both a good thing and a bad thing? Because, you know, like the the pain recedes as well as the vivid memories of joy.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, I've often quoted this line of Mark Twain's, though, that I just love. At one point, fairly late in his life, he said, I have finally arrived at the age at which the things I remember most clearly never happened at all. And I've arrived at that age, you know. I'm not sure about those early memories anymore. They may be fictions completely. I don't know.
Do you write them anyways? Do you work from them as if they were truth?
Oh, sure. Because they are truth to me. You know, I mean, they're embedded in me, and they're what I have of the past, and sure, there's truth there.
Mm-hmm. I'd like your last poem to be the poem that concludes your book, Delights and Shadows. It's a poem called A Happy Birthday. And there's an image in this poem that echoes with an image that you've described about your father. Your father used to work in a dry goods store early in his life, selling fabric for drapery. And you have an image of his hand smoothing out the fabric. And, I mean, that's apparently a really strong image for you, and a very, I think, in a way, soothing one or pleasing one. And there's an echo of that image in this poem, and why don't you introduce the poem for us? It's called
Sure.
A Happy Birthday.
Well, that's an interesting observation. I never thought about that, but it is true. There's a section in my book, Local Wonders, which is exclusively about my father's hands and beginning to see them out at the ends of my own arms, you know, as I got older. Anyway, here's the poem, A Happy Birthday. This evening, I sat by an open window and read till the light was gone, and the book was no more than a part of the darkness. I could easily have switched on a lamp, but I wanted to ride this day down into night, to sit alone and smooth the unreadable page with the pale gray ghost of my hand.
So you weren't thinking about your father when you wrote that line about smoothing the unreadable page?
Actually, no, I wasn't thinking about him, but, you know, it is true that we... I think a lot of us must have had this experience that all of a sudden you're sort of startled to see your hands, you know, that they're something that you've almost inherited from someone else, you know. And I have seen my dad's hands on the ends of my arms, and so it's all mixed up. But in that poem, no, I wasn't thinking about his hands particularly.
So what are you doing now as poet laureate that you haven't done before?
Well, I'm doing a tremendous amount of traveling and you know, flying here and there. You know, I'm not much of a traveler. I'm getting the hang of it, but doing that and back and forth to Washington and so on. I had done some things that I think were rather unusual. I invited John Prine to the Library of Congress and sat on stage with John Prine and talked to him about writing music and songs. Some things like that. I'm also working on we're about ready to release a free weekly newspaper column that I'm going to keep up as long as I can, in which I'll introduce a short, accessible poem and talk a little bit about it. And then It'll be free to any newspaper that wants to use it, and it'll be posted on a website. It's called American Life in Poetry. And I'm really excited about this, but it has been really like starting a small business. You know, there's a lot of work to this. And I was helped by the Poetry Foundation in Chicago put it together and so on. I'm really excited about that. And that'll be probably my big project as Poet Laureate.
Well, Ted Kooser, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I was delighted to be here.
Ted Kooser is America's Poet Laureate. His latest books are The Poetry Home Repair Manual, Practical Advice for Beginning Poets, and a collection of poems called Delights and Shadows. This is Fresh Air. After Ted Kooser's eloquence, forgive me for being blunt. As Kooser makes clear in his new book, there's not a lot of money in the poetry business. That's why he had a day job most of his life, and that's why you're unlikely to hear poetry anywhere on the radio except public radio. Our goal isn't to make big profits. But we do still need to pay the bills, and that's why your station is fundraising today. One of the bills your station has to pay is the Fresh Air bill. We charge stations a fee to broadcast the show, and those station fees go into our production budget so we can pay our bills. You see, there's a direct correlation between your pledge and your station's ability to bring you fresh air. I hope you'll call now. Thank you. Illinois and North Carolina face off tonight in the NCAA championships. Along with other devoted fans, our critic at large, John Powers, will be watching.
I first got hooked on the NCAA basketball tournament when I was a kid. Although we lived in Omaha, I always rooted for UCLA's fabled dynasty. Except once, in 1969. That year, my dad's alma mater, Drake University, would have upset them in the semis if the crooked refs hadn't handed the game to the more famous team. As you can tell, I'm still bitter. Of course, back then, the tournament never seemed like that big a deal. Although American culture had much less media, believe it or not, children, there were only three TV networks. Nobody talked about March Madness. These days, the term is a name brand, and the tournament may be the competition that sports fans love the most. But not only fans. When Illinois scored its epical last-minute comeback against Arizona 2 weekends ago, everyone I knew was excited. From my mother in a Des Moines hospice to my hip L.A. food critic friend who was mad at his wife for telling him to turn off the game with 4 minutes to go. Even though we now live in a big box culture, which lets us pursue our individual pleasures, be it video games, obscure art movies, or TV networks devoted solely to food, the NCAA tournament has become something that binds America together. I know that may sound crazy. But these days, a lot of Americans find their community in pop culture. People throw parties for the Super Bowl, a game they don't really care about. They stand around water coolers discussing The Sopranos or Desperate Housewives. And along with everyone else, they rush to blockbusters like Spider-Man or the new Star Wars. You gotta be there on the first day, Quentin Tarantino once told me. That's part of the point. Now, nearly all of these things are, frankly, manufactured events designed to make money. But part of the allure of pop culture is that sometimes it manages to transcend its commercial origins and inspire genuine feeling, including feelings of community. That happened a few years ago when that overblown talent contest, American Idol, suddenly unleashed an authentic emotional groundswell for Clay Aiken, a passion that bound together millions into a community that actually changed the show. This same passion runs through March Madness. Only a fool would think that the tournament is pure. Big-time college sports are more about money than education, and you'll hear cynics say that most Americans only care about the tournament because it's a pretext for all those office pools. Yet those pools are really less about gambling than giving people in the office something in common. And though surrounded by money, the tournament itself miraculously transcends all the greed and intellectual corruption that surrounds it. It brings together teams from all over the country. This is a genuinely national event, and it gives small schools their shot at the big guys. Even better, the games are played by kids of 19 or 20 with all the heady emotion and lack of perspective this suggests. The games possess an erratic exuberance that almost guarantees unpredictability. Kansas losing to Bucknell? The Elite Eight 2 weekends ago offered 3 overtime games and was a marvel of blown leads, heroic comebacks, buzzer-beating shots, and agonizing last-second misses. They reminded me that what I've always loved about sports and what makes it different from other parts of pop culture, it's wholly unscripted. You actually have to play the game. When the final buzzer goes off tonight, the champions will leap in joy, while some of the losers will weep, overcome by sorrow. And I'll be watching, aware that millions of Americans all over the country are doing the same thing. We're part of a community, however temporary. T.S. Eliot once said that TV is a medium that lets millions of people watch the same show and still remain lonesome. I'm betting he wasn't a basketball fan.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jane Fonda talks about her movies, her father, her ex-husbands, her eating disorders, her aerobics videos, feminism, and her role in the anti-war movement of the 60s. She's written a new autobiography. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.